The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
Hi, this is the Takeaway Podcast for Tuesday, August 23rd, 2016.
We had absolutely overwhelming disclosure.
It's always the question about, is she trustworthy? Is she giving us the whole story? Is she obfuscating? Is she using legalese? Is she, you know, hiding and waiting until maybe it'll blow over? But it doesn't ever blow over. It blows up.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. And this week, Hillary Clinton's supporters are looking back to 2013 and wishing that Secretary Clinton hadn't added her name to the William J. Clinton Foundation when she left the State Department, or maybe even further back to 2009, when the foundation continued to take donations from foreign governments while she was Secretary of State. Those donations were vetted through State and the White House, with a couple of notable exceptions. Back in June, Hillary Clinton herself maintained that for the most part, the foundation is and was transparent.
Were there, you know, one or two instances that slipped through the cracks? Yes. But was the overwhelming amount of anything that anybody gave the foundation disclosed? Absolutely. And I'm proud of the foundation. I'm proud of the work that it has done.
Well, last week, Hillary Clinton promised that if she wins in November, that foundation will no longer accept foreign or corporate money. Bill Clinton will also step down from the board, but with new caches of emails being released to the public, this week also exposed what makes Hillary Clinton's supporters cringe, evidence that big donors to the foundation had access to Hillary Clinton as the Secretary of State. So the bottom line here, this race is now Hillary's to lose. The foundation and the story that the emails tell represent, at the very least, an appearance of conflict of interest. Gail Sheehy is the author of the biography Hillary's Choice and a contributing editor to Vanity Fair, and she joins me now in the studio. Gail Sheehy, welcome.
I'm so happy to be back here. You know, I was talking with John Hockenberry on this show in 2009.
When Hillary Clinton was going to the State Department, and this was an issue even then.
Even then. And the question was, Saudi Arabia contributing to the Clinton Foundation, other countries with dubious records on authoritarian and human rights violations.
And so we have all these milestones going through Hillary Clinton's recent career to the point now of the campaign where even her supporters are seeing the emails that are being released, which do show that foundation donors had access to meetings with her. Let's say there's no evidence that any inappropriate action was taken, but there is an appearance now of conflict of interest where her supporters think that this foundation has become something that it shouldn't have.
Right. And this is always the problem with the Clintons. They never get around the story when there's an appearance of problems. They wait until the house is on fire before they actually take action.
Was this an attitude of, we have a higher purpose, these normal appearances of conflict of interest, we know we're okay, it doesn't matter what people think?
I think that's part of it, but I think the gut instinct of Hillary Clinton is to lock down. That's always been her Achilles heel. She said very early on in 1992 to me, you know, we're going to run against the press and the Republican attack machine. You run against the press, you run the risk of constant probing until it gets worse and worse and worse. And here we have a movie that we've already seen before. Donald Trump running around with his considerable hair on fire, calling for a special prosecutor. How did we get this far?
Because of the emails that have come out pursuant to a whole different Clinton investigation, there now is evidence, not of favors being done, but of access being given. People who gave to the foundation, being able to meet with the Secretary of State on the other side. For supporters, this seems to have already gone too far.
There isn't a scintilla of evidence that she has ever taken any action as Secretary of State pursuant to the big money that's been donated to the Clinton Foundation. But they've never answered the question, did she consider Clinton Foundation personal business when she destroyed the 30,000 personal emails? And if so, there could be a smoking gun that could blow this thing wide open, despite the fact that she has about 85% chance of winning the election now, but could lose it.
And talk about the perception of Hillary Clinton, even among many of her supporters, more importantly, perhaps, among her reluctant supporters, who might see Donald Trump as someone they could never vote for. But it seems to me that this entire discussion we're having is a reinforcement for a lot of people of something that they're bringing to the table about Hillary that they do not like.
It's always the question about, is she trustworthy? Is she giving us the whole story? You know, hiding and waiting until maybe it'll blow over. But it doesn't ever blow over. It blows up. And here we have a special prosecutor being called for by Donald Trump. It's absurd, but it should really concern them. Why not get out ahead of it now and say, she's going to be president. We're going to win. So let's cut the ties now.
What would that mean on a practical level to cut the ties? The foundation, under your scenario, Gail Sheehy, would still exist, still a project for Bill Clinton, right? Future first gentleman under your scenario?
He's going to have to sacrifice his identity, his standing in the world as the great humanitarian in order to help save Hillary's chance to be president.
And how many big Clinton supporters, Clinton donors, people like that have you talked to who wonder aloud, why am I living through this again? Why did it get to this point?
I've never seen such a bunch of sad sacks on the first night of the Clinton convention. They were just all talking about, why do they keep doing it? Why do they keep doing this? Why do they keep allowing this to happen? And then things got much better. You know, Michelle Obama said, which I think the Clinton should act on, when they go low, we go high. Why don't they go high this time? They don't wait until they're up against the wall, about ready to be, you know, taken to the clink before they do something to say, we don't need this suspicion. We don't need this obfuscation. We don't need to be lawyerly about just how far we're going to pull back on something that's a crisis. We're going to take it the whole way.
Gail Sheehy is one of many influential Clinton supporters who are urging former Secretary of State and current presidential nominee Hillary Clinton to go high on the Clinton Foundation and at the very least separate herself completely from an organization that is causing her political trouble at a point where they're getting very late in the campaign. Gail Sheehy of Vanity Fair, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
You know, there's a similarity here between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and it's that while other people swirl around them and worry about conflicts, the candidates themselves seem to be unconcerned. Now, political conflicts of interest are also a factor in a Trump presidency. His holdings include residential buildings and hotels and golf courses all around the world. There are foreign investors and foreign co-owners of businesses Trump invests in. A recent New York Times investigation found that his businesses have an estimated $650 million in business debt, some of it to the largest bank in China. Now, Donald Trump says his children would run his operations if he becomes president. Robert Kellner is a partner at Covington & Burling and is chair of the Election and Political Law Practice Group. He advises corporations and presidential political appointees on compliance and ethical issues. Robert Kellner, welcome.
Thank you very much, Todd.
What would a candidate in Donald Trump's position normally do? What's appropriate here ethically if he were to become president?
Traditionally, presidents have placed their assets, their wealth, in a blind trust. So if they had stocks or mutual funds, all of that would be dumped into a bank account over which they had no control, and they would appoint somebody else to handle their investments.
Now, does that work in this case? Because it can be dumped into a blind account, but Donald Trump, President Trump, would still know that he has business ties to China, that he has business ties to Russian investors. There's no way for him to forget that.
That's right. It's really very difficult to see how a blind trust would work for Donald Trump or for anybody like Donald Trump, because much of his wealth is locked up in golf courses, in commercial office buildings, and you can't put that in a bank account. So the whole concept of the blind trust really doesn't work for Donald Trump, even if he has his family take over his operations. He's still, of course, going to know that the family wealth is largely invested in real estate and golf courses, and actions he takes as president might affect those things.
And that, at the very least, we should say, is an appearance of conflict of interest, not an implication that a President Trump would take actions necessarily to benefit solely himself. But I guess the point here, Robert Kellner, is that the rules are different for presidents, right? There are strict rules for cabinet secretaries and people like that who you advised. But in reality, for Donald Trump, nor for that matter for Hillary Clinton, they don't have to do anything, right? This is all voluntary ethics.
That's right, Todd. I mean, interestingly, the federal conflicts of interest statute that does apply to cabinet secretaries, it applies to all the many government officials that the president appoints, That statute actually does not apply to the President of the United States for a very good reason, which is that under the U.S. Constitution, it's unlikely that Congress could ever pass a statute that would restrict the powers of the president as spelled out in the Constitution. So for a cabinet secretary, we can say, you have a conflict of interest, you're going to have to recuse yourself from a particular decision or a particular matter, or you'll have to divest yourself of certain assets. But the president has a constitutional responsibility to make decisions. He can't constitutionally recuse himself from any matter at all. And that's why the financial conflicts of interest statute just doesn't apply to the president of the United States.
So why is appearance of conflict of interest then so important here? I mean, if it's the case that Donald Trump's supporters don't really care whether he has foreign business interests or owes this $650 million in business debt, if they're sort of okay with it, why is the appearance of conflict still important?
Frankly, I'm not sure that it is. I mean, I think the entire American electorate understands very well by this point that Donald Trump is a wealthy man to one degree or another, and that he's got all sorts of financial assets, and those are going to present issues for him if he's elected president. But the voters will presumably take that account when they go into the election booth and may decide that that's not as important to them as many other things. And I think that the key thing is that you want to be sure that voters have sufficient information to make that judgment. And that's why there's been some criticism of the financial disclosure process, which is something that presidential candidates have to go through. Both Trump and Hillary Clinton have had to disclose their financial interest to some degree. And some people have said that the disclosures are not sufficiently detailed so that voters would fully understand what financial obligations and commitments Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have.
So that when Donald Trump disclosed something between 20 million and 50 million or up to 50 million, if it was 650 million, well, that form just doesn't capture it.
That's right. And in particular, the financial disclosure form really doesn't tell us very much about loans that he may have from individuals in the U.S. or overseas. So we have a rough image of his wealth and how he's invested, but it's only a rough impression.
Robert Kellner is a partner at Covington and Burling in Washington, D.C. He's election and political law practice group head there. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
There's a tradition, you know, when a new president enters the Oval Office on day one of their term. There's a letter that awaits him or her right in the middle on top of the desk, a message for the incoming president from the one leaving office.
I'd like to tell the next president to eliminate the barriers and tactics that are dividing the USA. The more you focus on creating an other, either within the USA or outside, the more the society will be divided and weaker, not stronger as a nation.
Well, this week, we're giving you the opportunity to also share your words with the new president, the things you think are most important, or maybe just words of wisdom. Anderson, South Carolina writes, I want you to work with all of Congress. I want you to have a feedback system with us, the American people, and I want you to show that you're taking steps to balance the budget and streamline government payroll.
This is Darren calling from Bozeman, Montana. Do not govern through fear. Set the standard of hope and resolve. Strive to make the country the healthiest, not the richest.
An organization called Poets and Writers asked 50 writers to also share their words with the incoming president. It's a project called Dear President.
There is no present or future without immigrants. White supremacy is one of the gravest threats to our democracy.
I'd like to trust that the voice of any suffering person, regardless of category, had as much currency with you as some power broker.
The first voice there from Juno Diaz, the author of critically acclaimed books like The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, and the second from writer Paul Lisicki. Here's Evie Shockley, a poet and author most recently of The New Black.
I would like you to know that we do not have any more time at all to postpone addressing the issue of climate change. And while you're working to ensure the survival of the planet, please remember that some of us are dying at an even faster rate from poverty, lack of health care, gun violence, police brutality, war, and 27 kinds of intolerance.
I sat down with Evie Shockley, who is a Clinton supporter, to talk about her message and why climate change first came to mind when writing a letter to the incoming president.
I think it is, or should be, the most easily agreed upon issue that we're confronting. People have different perspectives on many of the things that I listed, but climate change is something that is going to affect us all, some of us sooner than others, but we share this planet and we have to take care of it together.
And yet we have a race, not to dissect the politics too much, but we have a race where the candidate on the other side of this has called it a hoax.
Oh my gosh. I mean, I don't even know where to begin talking about the kind of disagreement with scientific fact, the disagreements that people have, or the denial, I think, that people have with what we know to be sort of empirically true. But I do think that it points at some level to the kind of fear that we have of confronting what could be the most, you know, potent and irreversible kind of issue that we will face.
Empirical truth is an interesting realm for a writer and a poet.
Yeah.
You know, I would expect a poet such as yourself to play with the idea of what's empirically true. And certainly writing about politics seems almost like incompatible in a way with poetry. And I say that as somebody involved in politics. So it's funny for a writer like you to tread into this ground, I think.
Well, that's one of the things that made me interested in participating in this Poets and Writers feature, is that generally in my poetry, I don't make a kind of straightforward statement like that. Poetry, while I don't think it's at all incompatible with politics, poetry is a place where you can be creative and engaging and use humor, in fact, to get people to think about things that they might not otherwise want to think about. So one of the things I like about poetry is that I'm better on paper than speaking. I have time to sit down and think through the language, think through the implications of words, find the exact precise word that I need to carry the right associations or trigger a thought in a reader. Clinton might have that skill.
Well, in addition to your short letter that you wrote as part of this project, you also brought along a poem, I think. It's called Whether or Not. Would you like to read it?
Sure. Whether or not. Time was on its side, its upside down. It was a new era. Generation Why Not had voted its con science, and a climate of indifference was generating maelstromy weather. We acted as if the planet was a stone-cold player, but turns out the Earth had a heart and it was melting, Pacific Islanders first into the hotter water. Just a coincidence, the polar bears are white and their real estate was being liquidated too. Meanwhile, in the temper-temper zone, the birds were back and I hadn't slept. Had it been a night or a season? The bird song sounded cheap, my thoughts cheaper, penny, inky, dark. Language struck me as wooden, battered. The words became weeds, meaning I couldn't see any use for them. I had signed my name repeatedly without any sign of change. I was still bleeding from yesterday's sound bites, and the coming elections were breeding candidates by the hand over fistful. There'd been an Arab Spring, but it was winter all summer in America.
There are allusions to weather, whether or not, to climate, to political justice all through this poem.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a poem that does, in its way, what I like to think that the statement that I wrote for Poets and Writers also does, which is to at least imply and perhaps get people to think about the ways that all these issues are interconnected. I started with climate change in my statement and in a sense in this poem, but there's no way to solve any of these issues if we're not thinking about how they're connected to others.
You know, I could see the person living in, I don't know, Center City, Baltimore, maybe, reading this poem or reading your statement and saying, yeah, I believe that climate change is a problem, but Evie, these other things you talked about, police brutality, gun violence, lack of healthcare, lead poisoning, that's my problem right now. I appreciate the climate stuff, but I got to worry about what's outside my front door.
I have no problem with that perspective. I think what we actually need, though, is kind of coalition building. There are people who have devoted their lives to thinking about, green sector jobs, changing fuel options, all kinds of climate change related stuff. And there are people, probably myself included, who have thought a lot more about racial problems, police brutality being the most prominent one right now that I'm thinking about. What we need to do is understand that those are connected issues. It's not an either or. Understand that they're connected, join hands, work on the places where they intersect.
Evie Shockley is a poet and author. Her most recent work is called The New Black. She's associate professor of English at Rutgers University in New Jersey and a contributor to the Dear President Project from Poets and Writers. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And we want to hear from you here in three sentences or less. Address the next president. Tell America's future leader about the issues that are most important to you. You can call us at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us a voice memo at takeawaydigital@gmail.com. And we're going to hear more from other participating writers and poets later on in the week. Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick, and you just heard from writer Evie Shockley there on her words, her letters to the new president. We've been asking you how you'd address the next president in three sentences or less. You don't get as much space as Evie Shockley gets. Tell America's future leaders about the issues that are most important to you.
This is Liz from Austin, Texas. There's too much poverty, too big a gap between the wealthy and everyone else, and no one teaching the masses finance skills, how to earn, keep, and grow wealth.
Hi, my name is Erica Veit from Newport, Rhode Island, and I think the next president needs to do everything possible to stop ISIS. Secondly, the cost of health care is just way out of control. And finally, the decision of Citizens versus United States should be overturned. And if things go on the way they are, we're going to have a plutocracy instead of a democracy. Anyway, that's my take.
Our listeners have very different assumptions about whom they're addressing there. We asked them to address the next president from Anoka, Minnesota. Dear Mr. Trump, please do what you can about our immigration concerns, and thank you for not accepting money from special interest groups, from Gaspar Fortiza in Florida to Hillary. Remember, a significant portion of the population in the United States is insane. There's no other explanation for Donald Trump. Do not kowtow to these segments of society and always do what you know is right. Now, you also have different opinions about where the president's responsibilities actually lie. We got this from Miami, Florida. These are the United States. It's okay if there are differences between the states. Your domain is exclusively those things which we cannot handle internally. So leave us to settle our guns and abortions and health care while you focus on ISIS and clean energy and monopoly busting. From Morristown in New Jersey, you must try to unite the people of this country. Division is our weakness. Unity is our strength.
This is Rob from Florida. We had better start practicing the policies of the rest of the first world, including public health care and education. We'd better do whatever we must to foster peace and cooperation in the world, and we better become carbon neutral, or we're headed for disaster.
This is Adrian from Springfield, Illinois. I think the next president should take care of Americans first, all Americans. We want jobs and peace. Stop putting your personal ideology before America's future.
Hi, this is Jack from Council Bluffs, Iowa. My three sentences to whoever ends up occupying the Oval Office: no more wars, no more poor, and no more medical or educational debt. That's it.
We got this from Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Global warming and climate change, childhood hunger and education, not rote memorization for standardized tests, but critical thinking, analysis, listening, and problem solving. We cannot be prepared for the future without a well-educated, capable population prepared to address, analyze, and resolve problems.
My name is Chris, and I'm calling from San Antonio, Texas. The issues that are important to me are the cost of insurance premiums, the cost of prescription drugs, immigration reform, tax reform for middle class and senior citizens, and lastly, ending the war in Syria.
And some of you want the next president to change our ways of thinking about certain policies.
This is Gina from Roslindale, Massachusetts. If I could say one thing to the new president, it would be to please have the U.S. lead the world in doing something drastic about climate change. The stability of our planet is in jeopardy. If we continue to destroy the earth, we will destroy ourselves and everything our forefathers worked for.
And finally, this from Brunswick, New Jersey. Please do not reform education to include selling out to corporate tech companies and charter schools. Please seek ways to invest in our public schools and support the communities where they reside. Tests and computers and promises of charter schools leave most children behind. We want you to write your words to the next president. You can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can always reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway or at the website at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. It's been 50 years since we got that first view of our planet from the moon's orbit. Taken on this day in 1966, a crude black and white photo from NASA shows a crescent Earth in the background with the moon in the foreground. The image was really the first to give a true perspective on just how small our home planet really is in space. Humans haven't been to the moon in decades, but earlier this month, the Federal Aviation Administration approved Moon Express, that's a private company, to be the first company to send robotic landers to the lunar surface. Moon Express's stated mission is to develop and mine the resources of the moon. On its own website, its co-founders envision a future where Moon Express brings resources back to Earth, even uses the moon as a base for further space travel. People have been talking about lunar mining and even lunar colonization for a long time. And Moon Express might be taking the first very steps to making science fiction a reality. Here to talk about all this is Jason Kendall. He's adjunct professor of astronomy at William Patterson University. Jason, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you for bringing me here.
And we're going to talk about the moon as a mining colony in a second, but I want to get something else on the table very quickly. Everybody is excited that this is the 50th anniversary of the picture of the Earth from the moon. Right. But we've surpassed that. I mean, we have the tiny blue dot photos from the edge of the solar system
that are
so much more expansive. You know, it even makes that picture seem quaint.
That first picture from Lunar Orbiter 1 was just an astonishing photo because it was the first image that came back from space looking at the Earth from above the moon. So you have the moon in the picture below the spacecraft, and it's this old grainy photograph. It was quite astonishing. And so even the achievements of the Christmas Eve event on the Apollo missions, as well as the pale blue dot view back from Voyager, as well as the recent things from Cassini, they're standing on the shoulders of the giant of these little bitty spacecraft that first went out into the solar system.
And the first one that gave humans that sense of aloneness and tininess in the universe.
Pale blue dot, we only see one pixel in the camera. It's just one tiny, tiny, tiny pixel. So we really see that the Earth is just a very tiny stage upon which all of our things are happening. We learn through the space program that we're our own spaceship, that the Earth is a spaceship through space.
Well, let's talk about the moon and using it for our own purposes.
Absolutely.
That's where science usually goes. What is there that we could possibly want?
Well, there's a lot of things, potentially. The first thing that everybody talks about is the presence of a gas called helium-3 or light helium. It's the same stuff that's in party balloons. But helium-3 is missing one neutron. Normal helium, the party balloon helium, has two neutrons and two protons in the nucleus of the atom. But helium-3 has only one neutron. And that comes from the solar wind. The sun spews out this helium-3. And it embeds itself in the lunar surface. And the reason for that is potentially to use it as fusion reactions on Earth once we figure out how to do that.
And the Earth is running short on helium supplies as it is, and not for party balloons, but for important industrial uses.
Yeah.
There are also rare earth metals that we need for iPads, cell phones, lots of screen technology.
Absolutely. There's a lot of people that think that there might be huge amounts of titanium and iridium or other rare earth elements on the surface of the moon as a result of asteroid impacts. So metallic asteroids have it in abundance, and it might be difficult to actually go to an asteroid and mine those things. But perhaps simply just go to the moon, go into a crater, find the stuff, and dig it up. So it's easier for small private companies to actually think, let's send a little rover to the moon, dig some stuff up, and launch it back. The Chinese are planning a 2017 lunar mission to bring material back. as had been done before, of course, with the Apollo missions, who had brought huge amounts back. And the reason we even think helium-3 exists is because of the rock samples that were brought back by the Apollo missions.
There's a reality here, which is that traveling a 500,000-mile round trip to the moon and bringing back tons of dirt is expensive. Where is the point where this becomes worth it to somebody to actually do?
Well, that's a good question, because it's a multi-billion-dollar investment just to do this. And with Google Earth prizes and Google Lunar prizes going actually at that and trying to get it to work, the goal is to actually see if that can become economically viable. I think what we can do is we can actually take it a bit further and think about in terms of what we really want in terms of a society, in terms of who we are. If we really, really want to get away from fossil fuels to help mitigate, you know, various effects of global warming and so forth, the best thing to do is try to invest in things like fusion, which can actually give clean energy and maybe even rig up a space elevator to the from the moon and literally have the material ride it.
So this is all to say that there isn't a present economic case for this, but there's very possibly a future case for it.
Right. We think of this as prospecting. So imagine going out to the American West in the 1800s and say, okay, let's go find some gold. And so let's go find the platinum. Let's go find the helium-3. It costs a lot. It's an enormous undertaking. It will be difficult. It will be dangerous. But eventually, I think as a society, that's our future. I think that's where we're going. If we wish to actually go to Mars, it'd be easier to build a rocket on the surface of the moon.
Because it's so small.
It's because it's so small.
And not a lot of gravity.
Absolutely.
You know, Jason Kendall, I've talked to a couple of people about this, and the same question always comes up. The moon has an important function here on Earth with its gravitational pull and the tides. Can we alter the mass of the moon in an appreciable way and alter our tides?
No. Simply put, no. The moon is really big. I mean, we think the moon's small, looks small in sky. No, it's not that small. It's an enormous body.
So surfers of the future need not worry. All of this stuff is going to be done by robots and cables. Are we ever going to get people back on the moon?
I think we will. I imagine that the Chinese, I think they're actually trying to replicate the Apollo program. They've done significant amounts of work on that. So I believe that we're going to be going back to the moon. I think it's something – because it's easier to get to the moon than to Mars. If we really wanted to talk about getting to places that are tough, Mars is really hard. But the moon would be a more important place for us to go. It's like visiting Antarctica. It's like working in that location, those remote locations, like at the bottom of the Mariana Trench. They're difficult places to get to. They're incredibly difficult, economically hard. But the rewards are amazing when we get there. When we think about it, because I remember the lunar launches. I was a little kid and I watched Apollo 16 and Apollo 17 on the television when I was very young. And I just remember the sounds of that old television, the old black and white, and the beeping of the microphones as they talk back and forth, and the excitement of Harrison Schmitt as he fell down a few times as he was picking up rocks. It was just an amazing thing. When we actually look at what the moon feels like to us as we look at it in the night sky, that's a place to us. It's a place we've been to. It's a place we can return to. It's a new manifest destiny, if you wish to use that. And I think that that will be someplace we will eventually go.
The FAA says, have at it, prospectors, mine the moon. Go there, find its resources. That's a first step. There's only a future case for this type of mining, but Jason Kendall is ready for it. He's adjunct professor of astronomy at William Patterson University. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom, supporting small business owners across America for over 10 years, with services including business formations and corporate filings, plus independent professionals providing contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Actor John Krasinski, he has a knack for characters that seem so real. They're just like somebody you know. You knew him as Jim Halpert, the shaggy-haired voice and face of reason in an otherwise delusional office in Scranton, PA. Since then, Krasinski has starred in a bunch of films, and he's gone behind the camera to direct as well. Krasinski gives directing another shot in the new film The Hollers, where he plays John Holler, a struggling comic book artist in New York City who returns to small-town middle America when news of his mother's tumor brings him home.
Would loss of sight in one eye be a symptom?
Possibly.
Oh, what about numbness in the toes and fingers?
Probably.
And temporary paralysis?
Definitely.
I told you.
What are you talking about?
Well, there might have been some symptoms before today.
Why wouldn't you get those checked out?
He sent me to Jenny Craig.
Oh, my God.
I thought it was a weight thing.
Dad, temporary paralysis?
The cast of The Hollers, including Anna Kendrick, Richard Jenkins, and beloved character actress Margot Martindale, they all sweep Krasinski's character into a whirlwind of problems. A dysfunctional family, a high school rival, a restless ex-girlfriend, and approaching fatherhood. Now, Krasinski admits that we've all seen a lot of movies about dysfunctional families before, but it was writer Jim Strauss's script that weaved drama and comedy together in this particular way that Krasinski says drew him in.
The hardest part about movies about family is they don't really feel real. You know, they feel slightly manipulated, that you manipulated to cry and sort of jokes that aren't necessarily the best jokes. And Jim has this ability to make hairpin turns between drama and comedy in a way that makes it feel like real life. You know, you're not really prepared for the bad things in life and you're not prepared for the good things, but they come regardless. So that's what he does so well. So I signed on to this project as an actor like 6 or 7 years ago immediately because I just thought it was one of the best scripts I had read. And then just recently got asked to direct and I said, yes, a resounding yes.
So, but directing that dynamic, right, where the humor is never far from the sadness, the mm-hmm. sadness is never far from the humor, they kind of go hand in hand yes. in this movie.
Yeah.
As an actor, it's one thing. And I would think as a director, it's a completely different animal, making sure that that doesn't feel stilted or 100%. Weird. Or
yeah. And listen, that was definitely the hardest challenge of this movie because you did get that so much from the script that being a director of it, you just didn't want to screw it up, which is normally how I approach directing. Just don't screw it up. And I really wanted to find the right actors for it because I think, to be honest, this movie would have been a very different movie without these particular actors. And I mean a worse movie. This is the perfect version of what we could have done. And I'm so proud of it because of that. But you have actors who understand that the truth is the best way to play every scene and allow people to find the comedy. You know, I had 9 years of training at The Office. You know, I think the thing about The Office that certainly I related to was that it felt like your office, that yes, it's a funny show, but really you were like, oh my God, there's a Dwight in my office, or my boss is insane. And in the same way, I think that we wanted this movie to feel in the same way, that real, that you're not laughing because we told a joke, you're laughing because there's a situation where you're like, oh my God, that might be my crazy brother, or oh, I have that same weird dynamic with my dad, or something like that. So I think the reality of the situation was always the guiding light.
You've got some nice performances in here. I think you've got characteristically great performance from Margot Martindale. Let's listen.
How are you?
We're having twins.
And you're terrified. Oh. Don't worry. You won't know till you get there that you're okay.
I have to say that my first goal was to get Margot. She was the first person I thought of for this role because she just is, to me, one of the best actresses out there. So I'm really glad you called her out. And this performance in particular, I mean, she's been in everything and been fantastic in everything, but this really shows her in a very special light. So I'm really glad that people are getting to acknowledge her.
So you've directed a couple of things before. You directed 3 episodes of The Office, which mm-hmm. you starred in, and a film in 2009, Brief Interviews with Hideous Men. But, you know, I mean, you're not Clint Eastwood yet.
How dare you?
You know?
How
I mean, you're
not, dare you? No, I'm just kidding.
You're not Clint Eastwood yet. And I only say that because, you know, when you're a young actor or somebody without a lot of directing credits to your name, it's got to be hard giving notes to Margot Martindale or somebody who's been in the business longer than you've been alive to be the director. How do you navigate that?
Well, it's really funny you brought up Clint Eastwood because I actually remember asking Matt Damon about working with Clint Eastwood, and he said, you know, the terrifying thing about working with Clint is he only does 1 or 2 takes. And Matt said, you know, after certain scenes, I'd say, oh, I'd love another one. He said, if you want another one, you can have it. But to be honest, I hired you to do the job I knew you'd do. And that I actually really took a page from that because hiring actors like Margot and Richard and, you know, Anna and Charlie and all these people and Charlotte, I mean, the thing about it is you hire these people because you know the job that they can do and they do too. So this wasn't an experience where I was guiding people to a performance. It was really setting a stage and sort of an environment that they felt safe enough to do the work I knew they were going to do, especially on the very emotional stuff. It's a very fun movie and funny, but really it's got more heart and drama than it does comedy. So I think that at the end of the day, it was just about, you know, staying out of their way, really. Just don't screw it up.
you've got something new coming up. You're talking about Matt Damon, action hero.
Yes.
John Krasinski, action hero, is coming up. You're going to be playing Jack Ryan on a new Amazon series, the famous Tom Clancy character.
That's right. I'm so excited about it. I mean, it's one of those things where it's also terrifying. Everybody says, are you nervous to take on that role? Yes, 100%. I mean, I think that with the actors that have gone up and done it before are obviously some of my favorite actors. Those movies were some of my favorite movies, and the books obviously are a lot of people's favorite books. So to me, the big pitch for me of why to do this was because Carlton Cuse, who is the showrunner, actually pitched the series to me as it's basically going to be one 10-part movie every year. So yes, it's episodic television in a sense that you're seeing one every week, but it's really long-form storytelling, which he said is actually probably more the way the story should be told anyway in a longer form, because 2 hours might be too crushed in to tell such a story, because Jack's whole superpower is intelligence. So he has to figure out this plot. It's a more cerebral take on the character. So I'm really thrilled and so honored to be a part of it.
I mean, I brought up Clint Eastwood before just as an example and kind of a little bit of a joke, but we're in a world now where it's Harrison Ford, Alec Baldwin, John Krasinski. I mean, that's getting real.
Yeah, it's getting very real. And I hope Alec knows that I'm coming for him. I tell him every day via email. He doesn't respond to those emails. But I tell him every day that I'm coming for him, and now he should know it's for real.
John Krasinski is coming up as Jack Ryan in a new Amazon series, but right now he is the star and the director of the new film, The Hollars. John Krasinski, great to have you.
Great to be here.
The Hollars is in theaters this Friday. Well, here's something to take with you today. Today is the day to light candles and celebrate the 25th birthday of a very special something in your life. The World Wide Web. 25 years ago today in Switzerland, a British researcher released the World Wide Web to the public. That was 4.73 billion web pages ago. Gosh, our networks, they grow up so fast, don't they? Well, the webpage is still online, that very first one. You can find it, and no, there is no crying Jordan meme on there. Or is there? Happy hunting, and happy birthday, World Wide Web. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillikin for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ or Curious Quotient through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/PRI. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.